You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we learn about a study on gun violence in Green Bay over the last few years and what it could mean for violence prevention in the future. Now, a new report from the nonpartisan nonprofit Wisconsin Policy Forum highlights budgetary challenges faced by many townships in the state. Cities and villages have similar shortfalls in state shared revenue, but towns have fewer properties to draw tax revenue from to fund services that often cover a bigger geographical area. That's forced some town governments to get creative with their financing, but it might not be sustainable. Jason Stein is the research director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Jason, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, I think a lot of times we might use town and village and city interchangeably. Town means something in the law. Remind us, Jason, what a town is before we get into the budget discussion.
Sure. So when we talk about towns as an actual government, not just like a geographical feature, Wisconsin has towns, cities, and villages. You have to live in one or the other. You can't live in both at the same time. And towns are not incorporated in Wisconsin, which means they don't deliver as many services as cities and villages do. If you look nationally, there's only 20 states with town governments and only 9 states that are like Wisconsin where you have to live in a town, city, or village. Some other states like Illinois, you can actually live in a town and a city at the same time because they organize things differently.
And a lot of towns in and of themselves might be pretty small, but collectively over a million of us in Wisconsin live in towns, right?
Right. So there's and that's because there's like 1,248 towns in Wisconsin. So there's a very large number. Even though there's only a small number of people that live in each one, together it's 1.6 million people. So it's like almost 28% of the state's population.
You checked out the budget situation facing towns around the state. What were some of the main things you found?
I mean, the one thing that really jumps out at you, if you look over the last generation, is how state aid has declined as a share of their budgets. And this is not unlike what we've seen happen for much larger cities and villages. In 1990, property taxes made up about 37% of revenues for towns in the state, and state aid was about 45%. By the time we get to 2020, property taxes made up 48% of town revenues, or almost half, and state aid had dropped to 30%, or less than one-third.
So they're getting more reliant on property taxes. There are downsides to that, I imagine?
Right. I mean, I think in particular for towns, I mean, one is that, you know, many state residents, you know, worry about the cost of their property taxes. It's a very salient tax that really jumps out at them when you pay it one time a year, unlike, say, sales taxes. And then, you know, there are pretty tight state limits on local property taxes. Essentially, to raise property taxes for your operating budget, most local governments, you know, there are some exceptions, but generally you need to have new development for that to happen under state law. And towns simply don't get as much new development as other cities and villages in the state. And even in the case of the larger communities, you know, if you look statewide, it's still less than the rate of inflation typically.
You mentioned that towns tend to provide fewer services than cities and villages. What are they on the hook for in their town budgets?
I mean, the traditional big thing that towns provide is road maintenance and construction. And, you know, if you look back to 1990, that's almost half of their budgets go to that one thing. It was 48%. By 2020, though, that share had dropped some. And I think that may reflect to some degree the financial challenges of towns because and we can talk about it, they've had increasing debt payments. Other things that they do trash pickup, they do fire and EMS services, which is another area where they've had challenges. So those are the kind, you know, law enforcement, things like that, more rare to see towns provide that. You see that more from counties or other municipalities.
To what extent are towns around the state getting stretched thin here?
Well, so, I mean, I think a good example would be the fire and EMS services. So traditionally, what towns have done is they've relied on a volunteer or a paid-on-call staffing model. So, you know, where they're not paying their fire and EMS workers at all, or they're only paying them for the actual hours that they work responding to calls. You know, that's a low-cost method. in a lot of communities, it has worked for them over the years. But as their residents get older and they're starting to have more medical calls, and they're also having trouble getting the volunteer staffing at the levels they need to respond to all those calls. And so then that puts pressure on them to either, you know, lean on their neighbors who may not be, you know, neighboring communities that may also have challenges, or, you know, it makes them think about, you know, increasing their pay or even shifting to full-time staff, and that, which is much more expensive. So even though you're seeing the share of town budgets going to fire and EMS going up a little bit over the last 30 years, you're still seeing, from what we hear, you know, greater challenges for towns to sort of respond to that critical service.
You mentioned debt earlier. Is that what some towns are having to do, borrow more money to close that gap?
You are seeing more of that. And under the state's levy limits for property taxes, there's actually an exemption for property taxes that you levy to make debt payments. So it kind of provides this incentive to communities in the state to actually use debt for things that they might have paid for in cash in the past. And we are seeing debt rise. So, you know, the debt kind of that's backed by town's full taxing power, that rose by almost 45% between 2014 and 2020, and now stands at essentially record levels. You're also seeing debt payments rise as a share of town spending, and they're not quite at record levels, but pretty close. And so, you know, there is a concern that over time, it crowds out other spending that these local communities may need.
Are there long-term structural solutions that people are pointing toward?
Well, there's a lot of things that could be considered. I mean, one thing that we have looked at for both towns and other larger communities is partnering with other local governments to deliver services. And particularly in the case of fire and EMS services, that is certainly something that may help towns continue to provide service and to do so, you know, potentially more efficiently, either by providing better service or providing it at a lower cost. Other things that towns, you know, may want to look at is ways to collaborate in other areas like road maintenance or road construction, looking at ways to, you know, potentially find new sources of revenue. You know, one idea that was floated by someone I talked to would be allowing, their property taxes to rise more quickly if the money was spent on local roads. So, I mean, you know, those are some of the challenges or some of the approaches that could be used to address some of these difficulties.
Jason, thanks again for joining us today.
Hey, my pleasure, Rob. Thanks for having me.
That's Jason Stein, Research Director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum, with us today sharing the nonprofit's latest report on budget challenges facing Wisconsin town governments. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Father's Day was just yesterday. Here's producer Steve Gotcher with a story from 2020 about the unique way he and his daughter have stayed in touch over the years.
When my daughter Erica was a little girl, she started a now 25-year tradition of sending me letters on pieces of birch bark. Last winter, we sat down and talked about how and why it began.
I remember having a book, and in the book, there were all these wacky ideas, experiments, and things that kids could do. And one of the things was you could put a stamp on a banana and send it in the mail. I saw that, and I wondered if it actually worked. And so I thought, what can I put through the mail? And I knew that you could write on birch bark and you could draw on it. So I thought, why not try a letter?
You have the first letter there somewhere. Mm-hmm. Why don't you read it to me?
Well, they all start the same. And they say, "Dear Papa, I'm writing to you on birch bark. I am having a great time here, but I miss you a lot. Love you, Erica."
I think you were 5 or 6.
Yeah, well, I spelled writing R-I-T-I-N-G.
So when did you decide to do it again?
I don't remember. I know why I do it now. I can't remember why I did it when I was younger. Now it's whenever I'm out in the woods and we're hiking and I see a piece of birch bark on the ground, I pick it up because it's a great fire starter, but also because I can write to you from wherever I am and it's a personal message.
Why don't you read the one you have right in front of you?
Dear Papa, I'm writing to you on Birch Bark. We are having a very fun time. I hope you the same, Erica. And then I have made a heart, a smiley face, and a swirly, which I believe was my signature at the time.
How old do you think you were then?
Probably 8.
And you are now 29.
Mm-hmm.
So you've sent me a letter every year or so.
The spelling's gotten a little better. Handwriting is a little neater.
Yeah.
Not much. You have to find the right piece of birch bark that can lie flat and can take the pen ink. Sometimes you have to scrape off a few layers of the birch bark, but that's neat because then you use that to start the fire and you write a letter on the rest of it.
And you sent some that actually have stamps on them.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you read that one?
Dear Papa, I'm writing to you on birch bark. Although this won't send until I get back to the cities, I wanted you to know that I was thinking of you and Mama out here in the wilderness. Will you and Finn come back here with me someday? It is magical here. I love you, and I hope all is well. Love, Bun.
Do you recall many of the places you've sent them from?
Boundary Waters. Yeah, up in northern Wisconsin. I've done a lot of canoeing up there. I sent you one from Alaska. That birch bark wasn't from there because they don't have birch trees up in the Brooks Range of Alaska. So I brought it with Minnesota.
Well, one of the things that I wanted to tell you is that these letters mean a whole lot to me. As you can see, I've collected them and kept them safe over the years. And I never know when one is going to come in, but I always am delighted to see it.
Well, I'm not going to stop the tradition anytime soon. There's two I want to read.
Okay.
Dear Papa, I'm writing to you on birch bark. I love this tradition we have, and I hope we never stop doing it. I hope your summer is in full swing and filled with biking, grilling, outdoor music, and paddling. I can't wait to do some or all of those things with you when I visit in July. I love you, Papa, and I think about you whenever I find new music to love. You gave me that gift. Love, Bun. Dear Papa, I'm writing to you on birch bark. We are about to embark on our journey north, and I wanted to write and say thank you for all the adventures you took me on and for inspiring me to go on my own. Thank you. Happy Papa's Day. Love, Bun.
Thank you very much for sending me all those letters over the years. I really appreciate it.
I'm going to keep sending them, so.
Erica is a wilderness EMT and firefighter in Montana. Because of the pandemic, we've not seen each other since January. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Coming up, we talked to one of the authors of a study on gun violence in Green Bay and what it can tell us about violence prevention. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. A new study looks at gun violence in Green Bay between 2019 and 2021. Green Bay doesn't have a lot of violence, with lower rates than many communities. That meant that researchers were able to include all incidents with shots fired in their study, rather than just homicides and gunshot injuries. David Muhammad is the executive director of the National Institute for Criminal Justice Reform, which conducted the study for Green Bay. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
What did you set out to figure out here as you started to study all of the shooting incidents in Green Bay over that span?
The intention was to do a deep dive assessment of all gun violence in the city of Green Bay and see if we can determine, is there a pattern, who is involved, what are the primary motives or causes, and how can we identify individuals at high risk prior to an incident to have effective intervention to reduce these types of incidents.
What did you find? What kind of patterns did you find?
I think first and foremost, similar to other cities, despite, as you mentioned, in the onset, Green Bay is dissimilar in that it has a pretty low rate of gun violence, which is wonderful. But the violence that does occur, the gun violence that does occur, is somewhat similar to several cities around the country, where it's very tightly concentrated. Gun violence is concentrating Green Bay to a small number of people, and somewhere between 60 and 70% of shootings, maybe even higher, have people involved have very similar risk factors. They are young adults. I think that was a big surprise to many people, that the average age of somebody involved in gun violence in the city of Green Bay is in their late 20s. And if you look at homicide victims, we're talking about 27, 28 years old, and suspects. The other is people who are very well known to the criminal justice system. So they have several previous arrests. Often they're under the supervision of probation and parole. And demographically, they're large. You know, it's disproportionately Black males. And the caution I've been giving about that statistic is, remember, it's a small number of people, right? So the vast majority of Black males in Green Bay are in no way engaged in gun violence. But we do know this small number of people who are well known to the criminal justice system. And the other key factor is many are connected to some sort of group or crew or clique, and some might call gang, but many aren't traditional gangs as we know them in this work, with, you know, signs and colors and all that stuff. Most of these are either neighborhood cliques or just these fly-by-the-night groups. But they are groups, and they often may commit crimes together. And when you add all of those risk factors together, it's a really small number of people in Green Bay, you know, really no more than 100 people who have these risk factors, who are driving the vast majority of gun violence in the city.
When it comes to the lead up to a shooting incident, whether it's fatal or even leads to an injury, is there a common story, a common sequence of events that takes us into that shooting?
Yeah, there really is. And I'm not sure. I think this might be surprising to many listeners. A common story is really a conflict around a young woman. There's a guy in town who might be dating my ex-girlfriend. I don't want it to be my ex-girlfriend, and I'm upset that he's dating her. And I am now in conflict with him in social media, right? So I'm posting things to his Instagram account or whatever social media. And now we're in a back and forth social media conflict that then plays out in real time, in real life. Sometimes that playing out as we bumped into each other at a gas station or at a bar or a club, that happens a lot more in Green Bay than other places. And now there's a shooting. And so you mix these kind of petty conflicts with the access to firearms, and you have these shooting incidents. The other thing we found, as you mentioned, we were able to really assess more than just injury shootings and homicides. We were able to assess shots fired, and there were many, many more shots fired. And in fact, the portion of shots fired when no one was hit was larger than we've seen anywhere, and which leads us to believe that these were deliberate, meaning people were deliberately shooting people's cars and maybe even shooting their homes, not intending to hit someone, to send a message, to scare someone. We were able to collect information on those incidents that are harder to collect it's harder to make an arrest. It's a question about a victim, but we were actually able to collect quite a bit of information, and those were similar to the incidents of homicides and shots fired. It is this small population that is pretty identifiable, and much of the violence is predictable, and therefore it is preventable.
Let's get in. I want to spend the rest of our time on that preventable part. Knowing what we know about that in Green Bay and maybe similar stories elsewhere, what do we do with that information?
Yeah, I think a couple of key pieces. One, the police department, which was extraordinarily helpful in this process, and really for a small city, for a small department, had better information than we expected going into this study. But that being said, I think the department could do even more by focusing attention on gun violence specifically, and they're in the process of doing that, having a team that just focuses on gun violence and nothing else. A second is develop more community services focused on this population. And this is a big one because there really isn't any programs. There's some great programs. I met with community-based organizations during the course of this study, and we sat down with several, even sat down with staff of the Packers. And there's some really great organizations doing great work, but there's not, and this is usual to many cities, there's not many, if any, specifically working with people at this very highest risk, the 25-year-old who has four or five previous arrests, who is not interested in services, but that is somebody we have to focus intervention on. And so part of the recommendations of the city is develop programs that provide mentoring, life coaching, case management, outreach services to these individuals. But the other thing, lastly, is a process by which we are getting ahead of these incidents. I mentioned that a lot of it plays out on social media. Part of focusing on gun violence in the police department is, are you monitoring social media? Are you looking at individuals who have these combination of risk factors and talking to them and advising them that they are at high risk, advising them that they have the potential to receive services, but that they are on the radar of law enforcement. When you do those combination of things, you really can get ahead of shootings and reduce those incidents.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That's David Muhammad, Executive Director of the National Institute for Criminal Justice Reform. His organization conducted a study of all the gun violence in Green Bay from 2019 to 2021. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, if you want to boost your health, go with your gut. A gastroenterologist tells us why our digestive system is so important to our overall well-being and offers some food advice and recipes to help. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, for a lot of people, the pandemic changed priorities and made us think about the things we spend our time on. We'll get advice to help figure out what we want to do, when and how we want to do it. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the State Department of Natural Resources has some new PFAS chemical regulations in the works for Wisconsin water. We'll talk to a water law and policy expert about the kind of impact those regulations could have. First, the pandemic led a lot of people to think about the way they spend their time. Why? Maybe it's because our routines were disrupted for a while there. Partly, it might be that the large toll of the pandemic might have caused people to rethink priorities and values. That could mean spending less time working, less time worrying, maybe more time having fun. It might mean just learning to accept that time is finite. We won't be able to do all the stuff we want to do. We're talking about how the pandemic caused many people to reprioritize the things that matter most of that to them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Did the pandemic make you think about the way you spend your time? Do you realize you were spending a lot of time doing stuff that really didn't mean much to you? If so, how did you break those habits? How did you refocus? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Rachel Feinzig is the work and life columnist at the Wall Street Journal, writing about the intersection of jobs and everything else. Rachel, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you wrote about this, the reprioritization that a lot of people were doing. What led you down that path?
I just want to, you know, make my own personal existential crisis everyone else's existential crisis. That's at least the feedback I got from a lot of people. No, honestly, the lead of the story is really what prompted me to write about this. I was taking a run a couple of months ago and ran past the elementary school that my oldest child is going to attend in a couple of months. And I saw all these parents streaming out, moms and dads, you know, holding their kids' hands. And I just thought to myself, like, am I doing this right? Like, what should I be doing with every hour? You know, especially now that I work from home and I have a lot of work to do, but I have freedom and flexibility too. And like, am I am I prioritizing the right things? And that's what motivated me to finally write about this.
And you went out talking to people, and it turns out you are not the only person on the face of the planet who was having those kind of thoughts. What kind of stuff did you hear from people?
Yeah, I mean, that's always the thing, right? Like, I don't want to be writing about things that only impact me. I wanted to get a sense of if other people from all walks of life, you know, not just, you know, I'm a younger parent of young kids. You know, I wanted to see if other people were feeling this. And what I found was they were. Like, a lot of people were thinking about time, how they spend their hours, just kind of feeling it differently in this moment. And it was super interesting to me and comforting, honestly, right? To be able to commiserate with other people and know it's not just you.
What were some of the things you heard from people about the ways maybe they found themselves spending time that when they looked at it, they thought, why? Why am I so spending so much time on fill in the blank?
Social media, for sure, was one of the ones that came up, just kind of scrolling your phone. Fantasy football, like this idea that there are things that we like, and it's okay if we like them. You know, I talked to one person, and this didn't even make it in the story, but, you know, he likes sports, and it's totally reasonable to spend X number of hours watching his favorite football team. But when it got to the point where it was taking over his life, and every weekend was just him and his TV watching a million games instead of, you know, spending time with his partner, that's when it started to click that, like, huh, am I kind of doing this right? So a lot of that, like, people realizing, feeling like, I don't have time to meditate or, like, do whatever thing that they wanted to or should be doing, but then being like, huh, my phone says I've spent like 3 hours on Instagram this week. Maybe there is some time there.
Talking to Rachel Feinzig from the Wall Street Journal. Rachel wrote a piece recently on people reevaluating how we spend our time making changes or trying to make changes. You could join in if you have rethought what you spend a lot of time on, if you focused it elsewhere, meaning maybe something more meaningful or maybe something intentionally less meaningful. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We asked around here at Wisconsin Public Media for some people to share their stories. Here's a listen to Muna Algaithi, Early Learning Education Engagement Specialist at PBS Wisconsin.
For me, the pandemic really made me reassess my time in that it made me realize how much I prioritized work over my own well-being and over my family. And so in that, I've really been able to reprioritize and recognize that at the end of the day, family and my well-being has to come first. And that was really hard because I absolutely love my job and I love what I do. And at the same time, I was committing way more than I had to my job. And I didn't even notice the way that it was taking from me and taking from my family and taking from my presence. And honestly, the pandemic really just enabled me to be more plugged in than normal because my home became my office. And so I've had to really challenge myself to be more present and to reprioritize my family and my own health.
Rachel, work-life balance is kind of a buzz phrase, I guess. But was that a common story you heard from people, like how much of my time and commitment is going to work versus the other stuff?
Totally. And like the mental and emotional load, like if I'm still thinking about it and obsessing about it and ruminating about it, even when I'm not on my computer or I'm running over to check, you know, because it's like in my bedroom and just work is all around all the time. Like, what's the point? And I think also the sense which we heard in that example, like a lot of people like their jobs. I mean, we've written the story about people quitting or moving, you know, somewhere new. And that's a totally valid experience too. But I was kind of curious, like, what if you kind of like most of the stuff in your life, but you still feel like maybe you just haven't got the balance quite right? Like the puzzle pieces aren't quite where they should be, but you don't need to quit your job and you don't need to move to the countryside. What does it look like to just kind of tweak here and there and just make like slightly different choices?
You talk to people, some experts and some real people about the strategies we can use to make those tweaks. One was just as simple as like limiting how much a phone is going to ring into our lives and bother us with updates and notifications.
That was a great example, right? It was a person that I was talking to. He works in the New York area, kind of for like a financial services research kind of firm. And he had set his phone to only ring when someone in his address book was calling him. It was this idea. He told me, like, those people aren't entitled to my time. Like those telemarketers, like whoever is calling me, they don't need to burst in when I'm having a real conversation with my son. And so it was kind of this protective measure that is obviously tiny, but I thought was great advice.
And you talked to some experts on time management, on how to manage our time, or in some cases, how to give up managing our time. What kind of things did you hear?
Totally. A lot of it was like really existential, right? Like, I mean, I've written about time management a bunch over the last couple of years. I've talked to a lot of those experts. I think they have good things to say. But for this story, I was kind of wanted the more existential point of view. And so, you know, Oliver Berkman, who wrote this book that has resonated with a lot of people called 4,000 Weeks, which is the title is based on kind of the typical number of weeks that people have in a lifetime. And I mean, his like old take is just like, let it go. Like the more obsessing you do, like, it's just counterproductive. You will never feel like you have cleared the decks. You will not, you know, we all say like next week will be less busy. Like the truth is it never will be. And you need to learn to tolerate that discomfort of knowing that there's a million things battling for your attention and that you're going to feel underwater. And you need to kind of let that go and pick the important things so that you don't have to feel like I can get to the important email once I've cleared out these 50 silly emails. So you let those 50 silly emails just sit there and you go for that important one and you give it like an hour of your like true focus. That's kind of his idea.
I want to bring on another story from a colleague here, Jason Butler, assistant to the director at WPR.
I don't mind wasting my time as much anymore. Like I've really come to realize that, you know, it's perfectly okay to waste my time. I really appreciated that idea that like staying home and just not having to go out was a heroic act. And like, and I, you know, it was perfectly fine to like, just do that. And I'm actually kind of resenting now this pressure to go out and do things. Not that I don't enjoy it, but like, I just feel like it's perfectly okay to kind of waste my own time. And I get to choose to do that if I want.
Yeah, Rachel, a lot of time management relates to maximizing our use of time. Jason there saying, hey, sometimes it's okay to minimize it and intentionally enjoy not doing stuff.
I think it's a really good point. And that's part of what Oliver is saying, right? Like we spend all this time trying to maximize everything. We read all these gurus telling us, you know, to prioritize this, organize it this way. And like, sometimes it's just better to let it go. And I feel like if you're wasting time consciously, like if that's what you want to do and you enjoy it and you don't sit up, you know, from like an Instagram hangover 2 hours later and like feel regret, if you really enjoy it, like, yeah, like that's the point, right? Just like go for it.
We're talking to Rachel Feinzig, work and life columnist at the Wall Street Journal, looking at how people change the way they spend their time, reprioritize time during the pandemic. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you change the way you use your time? Were there things that used to seem really important that you moved in a new direction? Less time focusing on work, more on family, less time on maximizing efficiency, more on fill in the blank for us. Let us know. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Wall Street Journal work and life columnist Rachel Feinzig about the ways that the pandemic spurred at least some people to rethink the way they spend their time, to come up with new priorities. Are you one of those people? You can tell us about it at 800-642-1234. Over the last couple of years, did you become more conscious about how you were spending your time? Did you see ways in which you thought maybe you were wasting your time or could have been spending it better? Do you leave yourself more slack in your day to do fun stuff, family stuff, you name it? Or have you just been able to set aside the phone and social media to be more present, as some people have? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you could post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Rachel, we heard from a caller who couldn't stay on the line who thought, you know, this might be a silver lining. A societal reset can be a good thing that we might not have otherwise had. Do you see people like not just kind of stumbling into things, but being really conscious about making something good out of this moment and thinking about how they spend their time?
Yeah, definitely. It's something I hear a lot from parents. A lot of dads who maybe were home more than they were before, didn't have that long commute. And now as we're kind of gearing back up again, going back to normal life, or, you know, in quotes, whatever that even means, you know, people want to keep that. They want to keep that slower pace. I don't know if everyone will succeed, but I think it's a noble goal. And I think people really are making changes with that in mind.
And slower pace, you just said, is that the trend, the norm you saw from a lot of people, what they were aspiring or working toward?
Yes and no. I mean, that was the case with some people. Other people told me they had, you know, decided to come up with bigger goals. Like, this made them feel, I talked to one person who had served as a nurse's aide in an ICU treating really sick COVID patients. He's a professor and a former Jesuit priest. And he said it had made him feel really grateful for his body, made him cherish little things, you know, like the ability to take a walk or feel the sunshine. But it had also, like, kind of gotten him into gear to set these big goals. He's training for an Ironman triathlon. Like, I think for some people it's the opposite of slowing down, right? But it's like some sort of balance there. But like you can go too far, you know, down that road too, where you're like maximizing, or at least in my experience, like, this is something I was struggling with. Like, you feel like every 30 seconds has to be accounted for, and then like, and Oliver Berkman says that's not, you know, great either. So it's all a balance.
We heard from Paul Damberg, our Northern Regional Manager here at WPR. He says he started woodworking when he had to work from home. His wife, who's retired, felt he was encroaching on her space. So Paul made himself a shop, started woodworking, and he writes, I started to do woodworking and repairing and manufacturing all hardwood wood products, first trivets and cutting boards, then friends' furniture and building furniture for myself and my son. It's become more than a hobby, he says, now a passion. He's rethinking how to do some of the work after some medical issues, but he says he's smitten with woodworking, can't wait to start doing more serious projects. And that, it seems like, is something that I've heard from a lot of people. They've found either rekindled or found a new passion, whether it's a hobby or some other activity like that. Is that something you heard from people, Rachel?
Yes. And I did another column that I kind of think of as related to this one a couple of weeks ago. And the headline was something like, how to be more than just your job. And I think that's part of it, right? Like, diversifying, having something else in your life besides just job and family. Obviously, both those things can be great. But when they're your entire identity, like, I think for many people, it's not the best thing. And having something else that makes you feel like you, that gives you, someone, an expert for that story, told me, like, it's that I can't believe I just did that feeling. Like, I can't believe I made this cutting board with my own hands. Or for me, it was running. Like, I cannot believe I just ran 10 miles. Like, I was like, wow, the last pick for soccer, you know, in middle school, and I became a runner during the pandemic. So I think that feeling is so important. And you kind of can't go wrong if you're chasing that.
Talking to Rachel Feinzig, work and life columnist at the Wall Street Journal, talking about how for the last couple of years, people have reprioritized how they spend their time. She heard from a lot of people, heard from some people around WPR. How about you? Had a hiccup with the phone lines. Looks like it's good now. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you call right now, 800-642-1234. Did you find that new passion in your life? Did you commit yourself to spending more good quality time with friends or family members, your kids, maybe? Did you decide to put more time into work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Rachel, apart from what we're doing with their time, and you've kind of touched on this a little bit, the idea of being present, of being engaged with whatever it is we're doing with our time. How big a part of the story is that?
Huge, huge. I mean, I talked to someone who had been working a ton earlier in the pandemic, kind of had an incident of severe burnout that made her reevaluate everything. I mean, she didn't have a choice. She like woke up one morning and couldn't get out of bed. She was so exhausted. And she ended up taking some time off from work. And she told me it was kind of in that quiet that she learned how to reprioritize her time, that she learned how to be present, how to really feel like herself. I think when we get so busy, it's like we go on autopilot, right? And so sometimes you do have to just slow down to be present. But I don't know. For me, it's made such a huge difference in terms of the time I spend with my kids. When my mind isn't somewhere else at the same time, I feel like I get like triple the bang for my buck, you know, like in terms of the time I'm spending with them. Like I get the funny moments and the smiles and like, sure, sometimes they're screaming and, you know, then you don't really feel like being present for that. But in general, it's just like, that's really where you like build those memories. And so much of this is about memory, because that's like what we actually take with us from our hours.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Anne is with us in Waukesha. Anne, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
Well, I'm a teacher, 28 years in Waukesha, and always teach my sixth graders, find what fills you up, do what makes you happy, you know, all of that. And then I finally realized I needed to do that after the pandemic and teaching through that. So I took a chance. Oh, I made a little pun here. I auditioned for a musical, and I haven't acted on stage since 1988. So it was kind of a, just to throw myself in there, we just wrapped Mamma Mia in the Waukesha Civic Theater this past weekend, and I was in the ensemble and just had a blast, met so many great people, and now the bug is in me again, and it's not going to go away.
Do you have another audition coming up, Anne? Are you going to take another chance, as Abba would say?
Yeah, right. It has to fit in a line with my teaching a little bit. So I have to kind of wait and see what falls into place. But I'm looking out there, and it's just a lot of fun.
Excellent. And thanks for sharing that. Break a leg. Rachel, she went back, rediscovered a lost or forgotten passion. And as she said, kind of filled herself up with doing something just like she recommends her students do.
That is so cool. That's just like the coolest thing. I love this idea of people just rediscovering these like surprise parts of themselves. I mean, so much of this is just about having fun, like living a little, having fun. Like life is so short. I mean, it's a little bit trite, but I think so many of us in our kind of modern work obsessed world have kind of strayed away from that. Like, you know, maybe a 16-year-old, or at least 16-year-old me, didn't need to be told to choose the fun thing, but, you know, 30-something me, like, does, and it sounds like Anne did that, like, just choosing the joyful thing and taking a chance. It's just, it's incredible.
Thanks again for that call. Now, Rachel, you were already thinking about this before you set off to write this piece. Is there a piece of advice you got either from one of the sources you talked to or one of the experts you talked to that you are thinking, yeah, I got to integrate this into my life?
I think it's the idea of not clearing the decks. Like, I have that feeling all the time where it's like, I can get to the real stuff, you know, whether that's in my work or at home, like I can get to the important stuff once I take care of all this other stuff that's driving me crazy. And like, maybe you just let that other stuff be, and like, you just leave it on your to-do list and you see what happens. And maybe no one will die if it takes you a week to get back to that unimportant email, you know? That's been something that's been really meaningful for me.
So if I finally made the decision that I'm never going to delete those thousands of emails on my personal and work accounts, it's going to work out okay?
Yeah, I did another column called like How to Care Less About Your Email. And it's shocking. People just declare email bankruptcy. They go on vacation. They just ignore everything. And they're like, the shocking part is like nothing happens. Like it's pretty much just fine. No one cares.
Rachel, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rachel Feinzig is the work and life columnist at the Wall Street Journal, writing about the intersection of jobs and everything else. She talked to us about a piece she wrote about how the pandemic caused people to rethink what matters most to them and change the way they spend their time. Still time for you to share your story of how you spend your time and if it's changed over the last couple of years. You could let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. If you rekindled an old hobby, an old passion, or found a new one, let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, we'll learn more about new water standards in Wisconsin for synthetic chemicals known as PFAS and some new advisory guidelines coming from the EPA on that. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.